Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Mark Casso, president of Casso Travel, and your moderator for today's program. It is now my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guest, Rick Steve, PBS travel host and author of the new book, Travel is a Political Act. So, a few words about Rick. He was born in Edmonds, Washington, and he started teaching travel at the University of Washington itself. He led many tours during the course of in Europe throughout the summer. His first book was known as Europe Through the Back Door. Now, presently, he currently hosts Rick Steves Europe and travels with Rick Steves. He also writes numerous guidebooks, and you can find him in many different venues as well as on his blog. In addition to all of his travel activities and extremely frequent travel schedule, he's also a noted philanthropist and has founded the Trinity Place in Washington, which is an apartment complex and a transitional housing for women and children. Plus all of his travel adventures, he's a noted musician. He's a pianist. He's professional with a guitar. He has the knowledge of the sousaphone. And in doing a little research about him, I also found that he is a rapper. As he said in his own blog at ricksteves.com, I found that the most effective way to annoy our two kids is to act like someone from their generation. Slang, greetings, gestures, you name it. If I try something from their generation and not mine, look out, it's tight. So when Jackie's high school radio station asked me to fund the purchase of some of their gear with a donation in return for an ad on their station, I said, sweet. On the condition that they help me produce a rap. I highly recommend you take a listen to that rap on his blog. It is fantastic. And I think if he does decide to enter a new career as rap star, he's got a good foundation, as well as a great opportunity to further embarrass his kids. So without any further ado, I'm pleased to present Rick Steves.
Thank you very much. And you will not be hearing any rapping right now, I can promise you that. What you're going to hear is lessons I've learned from 30 years of traveling through Europe. I've spent a third of my adult life living out of a suitcase, talking with people who have nowhere near the freedom or opportunity or affluence that I may have and who would not trade passports. People who don't have the American dream, people who have their own dream, the Sri Lankan dream, the Moroccan dream, the Bulgarian dream, the Norwegian dream. I used to think that was sort of off-putting. What, you don't really want to be like me? I'm an American. Doesn't everybody want to be like me? No, they want to be like them. And that's a beautiful thing. And when you travel, you learn to celebrate the diversity on this planet rather than be threatened by it. And I find there's a lot of fear rattling around in our community, in our society today, and people who are powerful actually using fear against us to keep us in place. And anytime somebody's going to use fear against me, I'm going to put my foot down and in my own little world do my best to get over it. And I find when it comes to travel that the flip side of fear in so many cases is simply understanding. If I'm afraid of a place, it's because I don't know enough about it. When you're afraid of a place, when you don't know enough about a place, people who want to shape your perception of that place can have their way with you. But if you go there, you humanize the place. A year ago, I went to Iran, and I was afraid to go to Iran. But I firmly believe that it's just good style, good character to know people before you bomb them. You know, it's governments want to dehumanize our enemies so we can bomb them without crying. And, you know, sometimes you got to kill people. I'm not saying you don't need a military, but it should hurt when you do that, you see. And I was afraid. I was afraid to go to Iran. I came within just an inch of leaving my big, fancy, expensive camera in Athens and flying into Tehran with our little sneak camera, thinking people are going to be throwing stones at us on the streets of Iran when they realize we're an American film crew. I've never been so warmly received anywhere as when I was in Iran, and I'll tell you more about that later. But it's just inspired me to get into this teaching that I call travel as a political act. I've been busy with this travel teaching ever since I was a kid. I've been at it now for 30 years. I wrote my first book in 1980, Europe Through the Back Door, and today I'm doing exactly the same thing, but with a staff of 70 people and all sorts of technological innovations that make amplifying our teaching wildly beyond anything we would have imagined back in the 80s, you know. It's a beautiful time to be teaching travel. If I look at my own career as a travel teacher, and I've spent 4 months a year every year since the 70s in Europe, making all sorts of mistakes, taking careful notes, losing my traveler's checks just to see what'll happen, working up a big thirst after a long day of sightseeing in Naples, coming back to the hotel asking for a margarita and getting a pizza. You know? Taking careful notes. When I get ripped off, I celebrate because they don't know who they just ripped off. I'm going to learn that scam, bring it home, and put it into my guidebooks, all right? That's what I do for a living. And I love my work, and it's really fun to be here to talk to all of you and so on. And I've been noticing lately how my teaching has just been on a sliding, what I think is an upward ramp on this pyramid. If you know Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where first you eat and get clothes and a roof over your head, and then when you're a little more successful, you get into fulfillment. And then I think the highest end is getting into not self-actualization, but altruism. And really, when I look at my teaching, there's a sort of a similar kind of pyramid. And you start off just knowing, worrying about how can I eat and sleep and stay healthy and catch the train. And then that was my first decade, 1980s, Europe Through the Back Door, Budget Travel Tips. I've written 30 guidebooks. That's the flagship of those books, Europe Through the Back Door, How to Travel. And then in the 90s, I found myself abandoning a little bit of that focus on budget skills and learning, thinking more about getting into the history and the art and the culture and the cuisine and cultural appreciation. And I wrote a book called Europe 101, History and Art for Travelers. And after 20 years of tour guiding, realizing this is what people need to know, is how to get turned on by the art and the culture of Europe and the history. So that was my passion in the 90s. In the last decade, I find myself sliding higher up on that pyramid and talking about how travel can broaden our perspectives, how travel can make us better citizens of this planet, more aware of the fact that we are a beautiful 4% of this planet. We Americans, God blesses us, and God blesses everybody else, you see. It's just a beautiful sort of understanding. And there's a practical point of view, we've learned in the last decade that we do have to deal with the other 96% of humanity. We cannot go it alone. We're not strong enough. It's no fun anyways. Why don't we understand and appreciate and empathize with the rest of this world a little better? And I really believe that the most important souvenir you can bring home is a broader perspective. So that's what has sort of inspired my work lately as I talk more about traveling as a political act and less about how to get a good deal on a train pass, you see. So, you got to get the train pass, you got to get the hotel, you got to appreciate the art, and you got to come home a person with a better understanding of this planet. Now, it's kind of odd to be sharing this sort of thing as if I know all the answers. The difference between me and you, I would believe that you care and I care. We all have a worldview based on our life experience, and my worldview has a lot of travel, so I can share a little bit of what travel has taught me. It's not really important what I think. It is important what the rest of humanity thinks when they look at our country, and that's what I can bring home a little bit. So I'm going to go through some slides here. Looking forward to the Q&A part afterwards, but right now I'll just get into my slides and share with you what I mean by traveling as a political act. As a travel teacher, I need to bring home the magic of travel. I mean, there's natural wonders of travel, and my beat is Europe, so most of my experience is in Europe. I see that as the wading pool for world exploration, and then Americans can use that as a springboard to get off into more challenging corners. But my idea of good travel might be enjoying the nature. Here you're up on a ridge in the Swiss Alps. I mean, imagine tight roping on a ridge. I mean, this trail actually becomes on the top of a ridge, and you're walking on it for 3 hours. On one side, you got lakes stretching all the way to Germany. On the other side, you got cut glass peaks, the most incredible alpine panorama anywhere, the Eiger, Monk, and Jungfrau. And ahead of you, you hear the long legato tones of an Alphorn, announcing that the helicopter-stocked mountain hut is open. It's just around the corner, and the coffee schnapps is on. Ooh, that's a nice hike, you know? And that's anybody can get up there if they know how to travel. There's cultural magic when you travel. I'm very excited to meet people who are really enthusiastic about things that I didn't think merited enthusiasm. You know, I grew up thinking cheese is orange in the shape of the bread. Here you go, cheese sandwich. And you go to France and they're evangelical about their stinky cheese. I mean, this is a festival of mold. And they will proudly take you in there, grab a moldy wad of the best cheese, take a deep whiff. Oh, Rick, smell this cheese. It smells like the feet of angels. Imagine somebody thinks cheese smells like the feet of angels. I'm right there. All right. Now, a lot of Americans are threatened by that. They think, what are you saying? We don't understand it. We're all here. Are you saying you're better than us? It's not that at all. It's just sort of enthusiasm for the fine points of life. It's like third grade show and tell. You know, it's not I'm better than you. This is what I did this weekend, and I want you to know about it. I love that. And as travelers, we need to look at it like show and tell, not like the French are better than us. We could teach them a lot about certain aspects of our society, and they can teach us a lot about theirs, and it's a good connection. History comes alive when you're a traveler, and that's something I'm very enthusiastic about. For 25 years, I was a tour guide. It's still a big part of our program. We take 10,000 Americans to Europe every year on our tours. Last year, we took 300 groups, and it is so exciting to have guides that can open people up to the realness of history today in our focus, which is Europe. as a tour guide, you got to know what's important and what's not important, and you got to put it in contemporary terms and so on. And I got a degree in history accidentally. I woke up in the dorm. I remember thinking back on those days, and it occurred to me, wow, I've already got 7 history classes, 3 more classes, and I'm a historian. And it was just storytelling, you know. Why was it interesting to me? Because I had been to Europe, and it made sense. It was real. And today in our travels, we can have history be real. Here's the new parliament building in Berlin. Of course, Germany, you know, war, division, government in Bonn, end of the Cold War, Germany back together again, government moves back to Berlin. They've got this bombed out hulk of a parliament building that stood there on the Reichstag, you know, that stood on the no man's land of the Berlin Wall. Suddenly, the Berlin Wall's gone. The government's got to build a new government, a Congress building there in Berlin. And in good European style, they don't bulldoze the burned out, blackened hulk of the bombed out building. They renovate it and they incorporate modern architecture into the top, putting a glorious glass dome on the top of that Capitol building. And it's free. It's open all the time, designed primarily for Germans, but tourists are more than welcome to walk up that ramp to get very to the very top. And powerful architectural symbolism here. They can literally look down over the shoulders of their legislators, seeing what's on their desk. And it's reminding the German legislators that this is government by, for, and of the people, and we're going to keep an eye on you. We've been jerked around too much in the last century by politicians. It's not going to happen again. I was on top of that dome on opening week, surrounded by teary-eyed Germans. Anytime you're surrounded by teary-eyed Germans, something exceptional is going on. And I realized, wow, this is the exciting, emotional, symbolic closing of an ugly chapter in the history of a great nation. No, with the opening of this grand new parliament building, no more division, no more communism, no more fascism, no more war. Starting a new century with a new capital, with a promising future, looking ahead as Germany was really together here. And these guys were overwhelmed with emotion and joy to be up there. And I looked around at the tourists up there, mostly Americans, and I realized none of the tourists had a clue of the excitement of this. They're all just, you know, worried about their battery or their Coke or why didn't they air condition this place. And it saddened me. I don't want to be in a dumbed-down society. And I looked at those tourists and I thought, you guys have been dumbed down. Here you are, great opportunity, and you're clueless because you've been conditioned not to think. Tourism, they're dumbing us down. They make more money off us when we're dumbed down. There's powerful forces in our society that would find it convenient if we're all just dumbed down. Frequent flyer miles, duty-free shopping, fun in the sun, bingo, what's the power of your sunscreen? You know, that's okay, but you can do better than that. And you should, but you got to be careful because it's subversive to be thoughtful, okay? And when you travel, you can be engaged. And I made a little pact with myself, even if it's not good for business, that I'm going to engage my readers, my viewers, my tourists, and I'm going to expect them to be smart. I'm going to assume that they've got an attention span and that they care, and they want to grapple with this, you see. And I feel like I'm getting into a pledge drive pitch here. But it is so important that we don't let ourselves be dumbed down. And even in tourism, you can be smarted up. That's kind of what traveling as a political act is, I think. When you travel, if you choose to meet people, you meet people. You meet different people. You can cloister yourself with other Americans and go through Europe or wherever in a bubble. Or you can break away from that and sit on a bench with a bunch of other people who don't speak your language and learn that cuisine, you see? Simple little things like that and you connect. Doesn't have to be earth-shaking encounters. I met this little boy in Italy, and he was just staring at me. It was rude. Finally, his dad said, "Excuse my son, he stares at tourists." I said, "What's with that?" He said, "Well, last week at McDonald's, we were having a hamburger, and my son said, 'Dad, why do Americans have such soft bread?' And he said, 'Because Americans have no teeth." And, I mean, the dad was just goofing around. There's no meaning to that. He was just toying with his son, and the kid was confused, and he looks at tourists now to wonder if they have teeth, so I showed him mine. But all over your travels, you meet people who just are so much fun to connect with. One of my favorite countries is Ireland, because in Ireland, I have the sensation that I'm understanding a foreign language. And in Ireland, they have this wonderful gift of gab. It's a real thing. And I'm so charmed by the Irish talent for conversation, because I believe these people think in a Celtic template, and then they just translate it literally into English, you see. The old Irish. And there's something charming about, seductively charming about their language. They have all the time in the world to talk. They love to have a chat. The gift of gab. And you get it best on the west coast of Ireland in places shaded green on the map, which are called Gaeltachts. National parks for the traditional culture, where the government subsidizes small farms and traditional ways of life because they value it. even if it's not good for business, you see. It's a whole different ethic over there that way. And you go over here and you get chatting with these guys and forget your itinerary. We're just talking, you know. I was talking to this guy for a while, and I asked him after a while, I said, were you born here? He said, no, it was about 5 miles down the road. Later on, I asked him, have you lived here all your life? He said, not yet. You know? You got to like connecting with people in your travels. Now, for me, the big news, of course, is the unification of Europe. Europe's my beat, and Europe has unified in the last generation, and it's quite exciting. They've created a free trade zone of 400 million people with a $13 trillion economy to compete with our free trade zone of 300 million people with a $13 trillion economy. Europe has woven itself together. And that's a big chapter in my Travel as a Political Act book, because we can learn so much from Europe. We can learn from the developing world. We can also learn from the rich world, who is passionate about their capitalism and their freedom and their affluence and their civil liberties and so on. They're dealing with the same challenges and problems we are, but in a different way. It's quite exciting to see what they're learning from and how when we get in a war that just, in a battle or a cultural struggle that just won't go away, they've tried something in completely out of the box in a creative way, and they're succeeding. We can learn from that. When we go to Europe, we find it's Wednesday afternoon, and everybody seems to be playing hooky from work. What's with you guys? You should be working. And they tell us, well, why are you guys working yourself into an early grave? They work less than us. They work hard, and they make a lot of money, but they work less. And when some proponent of our system is threatened by European, quote, socialism, they'll say, well, look at that basket case pile of liberals over there. They don't make as much money as we do. Well, they make $13 trillion with 400 million people. We make $13 trillion with 300 million people. The whole sentence is they make less money per person than we do, but they make the same that we do per hour, and they choose to work that much less. It's simple as that. That's the way it is. They work less and play more. It's not right or wrong, but it is an option that some people might have. Now, Europe is dealing with the same sort of economic arithmetic problems that we are. They've got a very cushy sort of expectation of a comfortable retirement. All of these, their dad retired in this way. Now the kid's going to work the same way and retire the same way. But the problem is, in the old days, there was a lot of people working and just a few people retiring, dying young. Now there's a few people working, a lot of people retiring and living a long time. There's simply not enough people working to sustain all of the promises that people have expected. And you can't, politically, you can't just renege on those promises. It's going to be political suicide in our society and in their society. Courageous politicians in Europe are having to tell their people it's just not in the arithmetic. You see what I mean? Same thing here. Everybody wants more. Everybody wants to pay less taxes. Everybody wants early, whatever. It just doesn't add up. In Europe, in your travels, you're going to see a lot of demonstrations in the streets with a lot of red banners, socialist and communist banners, and the word lavoro. Workers, you see. So it's not good. It's not a revolution. It's just people that aren't getting the entitlements they thought were promised to them for working their lifetime diligently like their parents did. Big news in Europe is the opening up of the East. Overnight a few years ago, 10 Warsaw Pact countries joined the EU, something like that, almost the entire Warsaw Pact. And overnight, the geographic center of Europe moves from Belgium to the Czech Republic. And you got like 100 million former communists that are now capitalists. And it's a festival of pent-up entrepreneurial spirit. And when you go to Poland, for instance, you find just things are jamming over there. Now, of course, there's the economic crisis that's hitting them like it's hitting us, and I don't know what quite that means and everything, but they've got the same basic problems. But in general, they're just enthusiastic in the East about catching up with the West, and I'll tell you, they need the laws of supply and demand, just like any economy does. The frustrating thing to workers in the old communist days was being oblivious to the laws of supply and demand. You got command economy. Somebody forgot to order windshield wipers. Now people have to take their windshield wipers in with them at night because thieves will steal them and sell them on the black market. That's the way it was in Poland when I was first going there. People were literally parking their car, taking their windshield wipers in with them at night simply because they didn't have the free laws of supply and demand having a supply meet the demand. Of course, now supply and demand has kicked in the East. People are leaving their windshield wipers on at night, and people are catching up and thriving in Eastern Europe. It's a very interesting time to travel in the East. Now, as Europe unites, an interesting thing is happening. I think a lot of us are charmed by European travel because of the diversity. You travel a few miles, and all of a sudden there's different traditions, different language, and so on. In our lifetimes, headlines have been filled with regions challenging nations. Basque people trying to break away from Spain, or Paris or France, Catalonians breaking away from Spain, Corsicans breaking away from France, Brittany people angering Paris, Scottish people angering London, and so on. Well, when I first started traveling, if you had a child in Brittany and you named it a Celtic name, Brittany is part of France, but it's ethnically Celtic, like the Welsh and the Irish, that child would lose its French citizenship. It would be laughable today. Paris was that threatened by Britain's secessionists 30 years ago. I was just in, all over Europe. You look on the city hall, and you find three flags, the region, the nation, and Europe. Ask a person in Munich where they're from. They'll tell you, I'm Bavarian, or I'm German, or I'm European. Ask a person in Barcelona, where are you from? They'll tell you, I am Catalonian, or I'm Spanish, or I'm European, depending on their mindset. For the first time since 1707, there's a parliament building for the Scottish people in Scotland, not in London. Why is that? London's no longer threatened by Scotland leaving. Why? Because as Europe unites, nations realize they're not going to be players anymore. Brussels favors the ethnic regions instead of the nations. It's a fascinating new dynamic. When I was first traveling in Spain, you could not dance the sardana, the traditional Catalonian dance in front of the cathedral. Today, it's no problem. The Catalonian people love to get together after Mass and dance the sardana. Now they're teaching their kids Catalonian first, Spanish second. I talked to my Barcelona friends, the region of Catalonia. They say, we're not a region. That implies we're part of Spain. We are a nation without a state. Do you see the difference? They are adamant about this. They are a nation that didn't get a borderline. Brussels is empathetic with that. If you go to an ATM machine in Barcelona, you'll find Catalan first, then Spanish, then Gallego, which is the Celtic language of the people of northwestern Spain, then Basque, then German, French, English, and everybody else. If you go to Basque country, you're going to find Euskara, that's Basque, and you will find Catalan, because Basque people and Catalonians are in solidarity with each other. They will have their languages on their ATM machines, even if it's not practically necessary. They stand with each other in solidarity. This man is the Indiana Jones of Tyrolean archaeologists. He enthusiastically renovates castles to try to teach people what it was like in the old days in the Tyrol. If he wants money for a big, expensive project like this, he does not go to Vienna. He goes to Brussels. And he doesn't go to Brussels saying, I'm going to do something for Austria. He says, I'm going to Brussels, and he says, I'm doing something for the Tyrol. The Tyrol is this ethnic region that ignores modern political boundaries that includes parts of Italy and Austria, Tyrolia. Then he'll go home with money from Brussels. So that's a beautiful thing. And because of Brussels' attitude on this, ethnic regions in Europe are more vibrant today and waving their flags more freely than they were 20 years ago. Now, when you join Europe, you're either a net giver or a net receiver. The European Union is recognizing the weak links in this economic free trade zone, this powerhouse of Europe, and they will, big rich countries give more money than they get out of Europe, and poor countries get more money than they give so they can develop their infrastructure. For the same reason the federal government paid for our interstate system back in the 1950s, rather than having poor states having to do it, in Europe they are investing in their infrastructure as a whole. When I first started traveling, the three poor countries of the original EU, Portugal, Ireland, and Greece, had no freeways. Now they're laced with freeways. And every time you see a freeway in Portugal or Greece or Ireland, you see a European flag saying, brought to you by the European Union. That means France and Germany. Now work hard, we're on a team, you see. It's amazing how Europe is investing itself. This is a new bridge in Greece. Greeks don't build bridges like this. They take the boat. This is for German trucks to get down and sell their stuff in the Peloponnesian Peninsula. They're investing in their infrastructure like we cannot imagine. It's like an internal Marshall Plan in Europe these days. This is the biggest new train station in Berlin. Major train lines coming together at different levels on right angles. I was just at a train station in Munich photographing trains coming into the station, more specifically photographing birds squished to the windshield of trains coming into the train stations. Those trains are fast. And it occurred to me as I looked at that poor bird, you'd wait all your life to see a bird squished onto the windshield of a train here in the United States. And it's a routine problem now for slow birds all over Europe. Now, we've come accustomed to seeing signs that say, stop USA, all over the world. And, you know, it's, of course, Obama's more warmly received around the world than a previous president, but it's just, it changes. Things are on and off. I've been doing this for 30 years, and there's always some reason that they're anti or pro-America. There, if you see a sign that looks like it's angry about the United States, wherever it is, it's angry about American foreign policy or American trade policy. It's not angry about you or me. I've traveled everywhere where you'd think I'd be blanketed in Canadian flags. My favorite places to travel from a people-to-people point of view are places you probably think might be, you'd get a rude reception or something like that. People love American individuals, and they're inspired by the ideals of America. Sometimes they just don't like our foreign policy. Okay? Please remember that when you choose to travel. You never need to tote a Canadian flag. Okay? That is just flat-out bad style. But I do think we need to remember that it doesn't matter what I think, it matters what the rest of the world thinks when they look at us. And the rest of the world, when they look at us, they are seeing 4% of this planet that spends as much as everybody else on military, and you can't even get elected these days. Even Obama can't get elected without promising more for military. What's with that? They see a nation that can declare somebody else's natural resources on the other side of the globe vital to our, quote, national security interests. Well, at least we could be honest and say vital to our accustomed material lifestyle. But no, it's our national security interests, as if that justifies us militarizing the world so we can have access to all those natural resources. Now, that's, again, it doesn't matter what I think about it. We may be the warm-hearted, compassionate policemen of the world and doing a necessary job. You could make a case for that. But what does matter is what the rest of the world thinks when they look at us. The rest of the world knows. And remember, half of humanity is trying to live on $2 a day. For the average lot for women on this planet is to walk for water every day, and they have to walk further every year. That's a reality. And when they look at us, they see a nation that is potentially a great leader on this planet, who is routinely outvoted in the United Nations 140-4 on issues that matter to the developing world, to the desperately poor world. If it's water issues or child labor or third world debt relief or all of these kind of issues, routinely, it's 140-4 against the United States. Who stands with us? Israel, Marshall Islands, and Micronesia. I like to be credible, and sometimes I say something that just doesn't sound credible. I check this at the UN website every year just because it seems just too wild. 40 or 50 times on issues that are third world issues, we're outvoted at least 140-4. It's an amazing thing. We need to, even if they're all loony one-world nutcases that want to turn us into some sort of a, you know, Stalinistic hellhole here, we still got to work with the rest of the world. We cannot go it alone. We don't want to be outvoted 140-4. Can we travel? Of course we can travel and be received warmly. I take 1,000 people to France every year on my tours. I survey them afterwards. How are you treated? Nobody says they were treated rudely, unless they travel with a clenched fist and they want to teach those people how to do it right. They've got different ways of doing things. I'll tell you, I could just fill the whole talk today with warm and encouraging anecdotes about how Europeans appreciate all the valor and the heroism and the commitment to freedom that America has shown in the last century. We have been a godsend to Europe many times. I was just in Burgundy, the most traditional part of France. I'm filming, you know, and I'm shooting this little castle. And when the sun's going down and I'm making a TV show, get out of my way. I got to get up on the roof so I can get a wide shot and see those turrets. No, we must have a little party, the mom and pop aristocrats that run the chateau said. And they're, you know, their families own the chateau for hundreds of years. And they want to sit down and bring out the wine. Okay. And then they bring out this, like a religious relic, this precious 48-star American flag that they hoisted over their chateau on that little town in the countryside of France on that glorious day in 1944 when American troops freed them from Nazi tyranny. And they said, go home and tell your friends that we love America and we're thankful for what you've done for us. Just because we don't follow you into one of your wars doesn't mean we're turning our back on you. You're our friends, you know. But we just think because of what we did in World War II, they need to follow us in our military adventures. You know, they may be right or wrong, but French people are proud people, and they're not going to follow us. And I'm haunted by the thought that maybe America doesn't know what a war really is. You know, we haven't hosted a war in anybody's living memory. We don't know what a war is. Unless you've got a loved one or lost a loved one in Afghanistan or Iraq or Vietnam, I don't think you know what a war is. You can read about it. But Europe knows what a war is. France fought a horrible war twice. After World War I, half of all men in France between 15 and 30 were casualties. Half of all men in the entire country were casualties. That's a war. In 1 month, many times, that little country, one quarter of our population, lost more than we lost in Iraq and Afghanistan put together in 1 month, and it's just routine. They know what a war is, and I think we need to remember that. In Europe, they also are thankful for us stopping the westward movement of the Soviet Union. We stood up and waged a very courageous and expensive battle of economic attrition against the USSR, and we calculated they would bleed white and drop first, and they did, economically. And Europe is thankful for that. There's a lot of Europeans just a few years older than me named Frankie and Johnny. Their parents were so enamored with American values and American heroism, they named their kids after American GIs or American pop stars. Lots of Frankies and Johnnies. You don't find younger Europeans named Frankie and Johnny anymore. That could happen again. This is the brand of America, you know? The brand of America. It can be fixed up. Terrorism. Teaching travel classes like I do, you got to talk about terrorism. I'll tell you, terrorism is overrated. It's really overrated. We're being made fools of by the media. We're a mighty country of 300 million people. We're seen as an empire on this planet, whether we are or not. We're seen as an empire. There's never been an empire with our footprint that didn't have angry people on the edges doing dirty things against us. You can call it anarchist, you can call it barbarians, you can call it terrorists. That just goes with the territory. When you spend as much as everybody else put together in the military, nobody's going to fight you fair. If you disagree with the empire, you got two choices, be dead or be a terrorist. And there's a lot of people that want to fight us and they don't want to die. That's the only way you can be fought. I'm not justifying, I'm just saying it shouldn't surprise us and we shouldn't overreact. We lose 15,000 people every year in our society in order to have the right to bear arms. And I could make a case that that's a small price to pay for 300 million people to have the freedom to have their own guns. But we're educated, we're democratic, we're free, and we affirm the right to bear arms every year at the cost of 15,000 people. What's it cost to be seen as an empire? What's it cost to live as well as we do on a hungry world? Well, a little bit of terrorism. You could make the case that that's just the cost that it takes for us to be as happy as we are. 12 million Americans go to Europe every year, 12 million come back. This year might be an off year, 10 million go, 10 million come back. Nobody's hurt, nobody's targeted by terrorists. Tomorrow, if an American is beheaded by a jihadist in Madrid, it doesn't matter. It's still safe to travel. A 747 worth of people just died on our streets this year. You know, you see right through that. We've got to get a grip when it comes to terrorism, and we've got to be not let the terrorists terrorize us. I was in England on that horrible day in London when they had that awful bomb, and the British, as a matter of principle, didn't let the terrorists terrorize them. Here we make it a media spectacle, and everybody jumps on it, and we overreact, and we put ourselves into a downward spiral. So I'm just trying to encourage people to keep traveling and to realize if you hate terrorism as much as I do, the most powerful thing we can do as individual Americans is to travel a lot, help the world better understand us, and come home and help our country better understand the other 96% of humanity. As you travel, you realize that different people find different truths to be self-evident. It is so exciting to realize that they've got different fundamental truths. And it just makes sense to give everybody a little wiggle room. And it's fun to realize they've all got their own festivals. They got different 4th of Julys. Here in Switzerland, it's August 1st. In Norway, it's May 17th, and so on. And as I mentioned earlier, people don't all have the American dream. They got the Sri Lankan dream. And it's fun that we don't all have the same dream. People have different struggles. As a tour guide in eastern Turkey, you don't have a list of famous sites. You just have to be on the ball looking for anything interesting. You see 300 high school kids in a stadium have a pep rally, park the bus, take your group in, and see what's going on. I walked in there, and we were close to the border of Iran and Iraq, and these 300 Turkish high school students all thrusting their fist up in the air, screaming in unison, "We are a secular nation. We are a secular nation." I asked my tour guide, "What's going on here? Don't they like God?" And she says, "No, we love God here, but considering the rising tide of Islamic fundamentalism just over the border in Iran, we're very concerned about the fragile and precious separation of mosque and state here in our society. It's a real scary thing for modern secular Turks to see Islamic fundamentalism creeping in and taking over their world. There's a lot of people in Turkey that want prayer in school. They want the Ten Commandments everywhere on their terms and this kind of thing." And it's very interesting for me to think that there are people that want to violate the separation of church and state or mosque and state, not because they're bad people, obviously, because they're loving people and they care about somebody's salvation. And in their own mind, that's how they can help more people, you know, be okay with God. And I've found when I travel in secular and theocratic Muslim states, the irony is when it's top-down dictated religion, there's a weaker fabric of spirituality in that society as when you let it be grassroots and organic. And the irony is, if you really care about people's salvation and souls, I don't think you want prayer in school. I think you want freedom of religion. And that's what Turkey has today. And Turkey has a much more vibrant, to me, Islamic spirituality than Iran, where I was struck by how secular it felt. So it's fascinating stuff to think about that. And you get to think about that when you're traveling. Another thing you think about is the fact that Nathan Hales, Ethan Allens, and Patrick Henrys are a dime a dozen on this planet. It's not a disrespectful thing to say. I mean, they're great, but they're all over the place. Every country's got their own people that wish they only had more than one life to give for their country. It's an amazing thing. And to remember that every year 5 or 10 languages go extinct, you realize, oh, every year 5 or 10 ethnic groups lose their long, slow battle until the last person who speaks that language dies, and there's one little bit of less ethnic diversity on this planet. They don't all die gracefully. They struggle. And we used to be fighting the redcoats, and now we are the redcoats. And we've got to understand that. Maybe it's necessary that we're the redcoats, but there's a lot of downtrodden people that look to us like the redcoats. Okay? And you get that when you go to the developing world and you meet Nathan Hales and Patrick Henrys and Ethan Allens. Go to El Salvador, and you learn about Archbishop Oscar Romero, a modern-day Nathan Hale. And he said, I'm going to be killed and I'm going to rise again in my people. And sure enough, he was assassinated, and today he lives in his people. I went down there a couple years ago for the 25th anniversary of the assassination of Archbishop Romero. Powerful travel experience. I had the opportunity to go to Mazatlan and lay on the beach with a beautiful plastic band on my wrist that gave me unlimited margaritas. A beach cleaned of local riffraff just for rich white people, you know? It would have been incredible. And I just told my family, I'm going to be no fun on that beach. I got to go to El Salvador. I'm invited to go there and march with those people. Now, that's not perverse. It's a little odd, but that's an appetite for learning through your travels. That's traveling as a political act. And when I was on that march, I saw a monument in the capital of El Salvador that looks a lot like a monument we have in Washington, D.C. It's a perfect knockoff of the Vietnam Memorial. And it's got just about as many names on it. Each one of those names is a loved one who died fighting my country. These people are on the cause of small landowners instead of big landowners, of peasants instead of big business, you know? And they fought and they died, and maybe we needed to kill them all. Maybe they're all just communists, you know? I don't know. But there's a lot of loved ones that go to that monument and finger the little name of the lost father or whatever. And that's a real thing, and we're connected with that forever. And when you travel, you understand that. If you don't travel, you won't know that. I had the opportunity to go to Iran a year ago to make our public television TV show. As you came in today, I hope you picked up this, if you had a chance to get this Iran brochure. I didn't have enough for everybody, but if you got that, that's a good thing to pick up. If you didn't get that and you want the information, it's all on my website. Or I should mention it that doing that journal made me realize I've got a book here that needs to be written. So the whole thing in that handout is in this Travel as a Political Act book, along with my experience in El Salvador with that Romero stuff and the secular Islam in Turkey and Morocco and, you know, all about the European approach to government and so on. That's what's in this Travel as a Political Act book. I guess I should just mention it's in the lobby if you want to get it. It raises money for the club here, and they're selling it at a discount. But I went to Iran, and I had an opportunity to make an hour show and bring it home. And it's kind of odd to be filming in a big city of 14 million and you see 10-story tall murals that have dropping bombs for stripes and skulls for stars, and that's the American flag. It says, Down with America, Death to America. And, you know, our media shows us that, and we think, oh, the Iranians hate us. Well, not really. They've got propaganda that says they're supposed to hate us. But I was on the streets. It's different. You weren't on the streets. I was on the streets. It's an odd thing. I was thinking all they do is say death to America. I was stuck in a traffic jam just below that, and my driver just burst out of the blue. Death to America. He said, death to traffic. And I thought he was going to say death to America. Death to traffic. I said, what? What about death to Israel? He said, here in Iran, whenever we're frustrated by something that's out of our control, we say death to that. It's kind of like we say damn. They're probably saying death to election fraud right now. You know? Well, we say damn those teenagers sometimes. Do we really want them to die and burn in hell for an eternity? I don't think so. It's just after midnight. Turn the music down, you see? So you learn when you travel. Iran's a beautiful place to travel, I'll tell you that. I sure learned a lot. They've got a lot of baggage. They lost hundreds of thousands of people fighting a tyrant named Saddam Hussein, who was the aggressor, who invaded their country, and who was funded by the United States. Now, their propaganda is going to make him an American puppet, and they go to their mass cemeteries, and every town's got a martyr cemetery, and they sit on the tomb of their lost son every week for 20 years now, and they think about, why did their son die? It's because America wants to put the Shah back in power. That's not necessarily right, but that's what they think, because they're victims of propaganda, and we're pretty easy to demonize. I had people walking across the street and telling me, you're an American journalist. I want you to go home and tell the truth. We are united and we are strong, and we just do not want our children to be raised like Britney Spears. Whoa. There's something going on here. They don't want their kids to be raised like boy toys, drug addicts, and crass materialists. They're scared. What motivates Iranians? What motivates Ahmadinejad's power base? Who are they? They are the less educated, small town, fundamentalist parents who are motivated by the same thing their counterparts here are motivated by, fear and love. That's pretty powerful stuff. And if we can at least appreciate that, we can talk with them and find some common ground. Beautiful people. Beautiful people. And I'd like to tell you more about Iran, but... Oh, I should tell you, if you want to watch the show, you can wait till it comes on public television, or you can go to Hulu.com and watch it anytime you want for free. Just go to Hulu.com, type in Iran Rick Steves, and you can watch the one-hour show on Iran. But you don't want to radicalize these people. It'd be quite easy to do. And they would fight to the end. They would fight to the end. Because for 2,500 years, their society has been threatened from the West by people who want to take over their government and bring our values on them. Liberty. A lot of places have a lot of liberty, and they love it. In your travels, you find it. In Italy, a little village where the teenagers are teaching the little kids how to make a good ravioli. In a chamber of commerce in a little town in France that believes it's worth investing in people to develop a good nose so they can appreciate the fine differences from wine to wine. Europeans love to spend more than they need to for a loaf of bread so they can buy it from the person who made it. We love to have a big freezer in the garage so we don't have to go shopping except once every 2 weeks. It's a different approach to things, not better or worse, but Europeans enjoy living well. They know how to get their fine wine, and they know how to fill it up cheap. And, you know, I've been thinking a lot about the legislation of morality. The United States is really passionate about legislating morality, I think. And in Europe, they've realized that that's folly, that's futile. My European friends tell me a society has to make a choice. Tolerate alternative lifestyles or build more prisons. And then they always remind me we lead the world in incarceration. We lock up 8 times as many people per capita as Europeans do, and either we're just inherently more criminal or something screwy in our society. Europe doesn't need to lock so many people up. Why is that? Well, it's worth thinking about. Prostitution? Nobody would say prostitution is a good thing, but some people might say it'd be more pragmatic from a harm reduction point of view to legalize it. Let prostitutes be unionized. Don't give them a license unless they're clean and checked by a nurse every month so they're not spreading diseases. And let them, as they do here in the Netherlands, when they have problems, they push their emergency button and a pimp doesn't come to their rescue, but a policeman does. It's just a different approach to things. It's a tough sell in America, but they like it. When you travel around Europe, you find soft drugs and hard drugs are a problem. And so are they in our society. We can learn from Europe in this regard. I was in Zurich, went into a coffee shop, went down into the basement, opened the door, blue lights. Blue lights in the toilet in the coffee shop. What's going on? I couldn't see my veins. I couldn't shoot up if I wanted to. Really frustrating if you're a junkie in need of a fix. And because they don't want their junkies in their toilet shooting up. It's logical. You cross the street and you see a machine that used to sell cigarettes that's been retooled and now it sells government-subsidized syringes. Nobody's passing around needles over there. Here we don't want to give needles out because they might use them, you know. Well, they're going to use them. Let's give them syringes that won't pass diseases around. It's harm reduction. A society has to have a drug policy. You can measure it in terms of incarceration like we do, or you can measure its effectiveness in terms of harm reduction. In Europe, they're more inclined to take the crime out of it and treat it like a medical problem. They're pragmatic. Here we have this just say no moralism about it, and it is not working. I've been speaking out on this quite a lot lately because it's hard for people to speak out on it. I can, and I can get away with it. From this needle machine here, the heroin addict would go down the street to a cafe fix. It's a heroin maintenance clinic. And I've seen them. They're ugly. They're all these wasted, emaciated needle addicts. They're getting medical care. They're getting counseling. They're getting their lives back on track. And they're getting help. A lot of naive tourists go to Europe and they see all these junkies on the street. What's going on, these liberal Europeans? Well, their junkies are not in jail and they're not dead. That's the difference. They're on the street. They're in their face. They're working with them. We lost 18,000 people to heroin overdoses last year. Europe lost 8,000. There's a difference in our approach to drugs. There's serious issues going on now. And, of course, there's the approach to soft drugs. I'm fascinated by, you know, marijuana being classified as a soft and regulated drug like alcohol or a hard drug like needle drugs and so on. In Europe, a joint is about as exciting as a can of beer. In the Netherlands, it's been 25 years since they arrested anybody for marijuana, and use has not gone up. And there's no indication that marijuana is a gateway drug. In fact, the hard drug-using population is aging in the Netherlands, you see. It's a fascinating thing. It's way beyond the scope of this class today. But we're learning now in the United States that we have a prohibition going on right now when it comes to marijuana, which is about as smart as the prohibition against alcohol was in the 20s and 30s. When courageous people finally stood up and said, you know, this drug is bad. Alcohol abuse is horrible, but the law against it is causing more problems than the drug itself. Let's find a smarter way to deal with this problem and regulate it and educate people. It took courageous people to do that back in the 30s. And nobody was saying booze is good. They're saying the law is causing more problems than the drug. People are going to smoke marijuana. In the United States, we smoke twice the marijuana per capita as Europeans do. And use does not go up. There's not a reservoir of people just wishing they could ruin their lives with drugs if only it was legal. So I've been having a lot of fun talking about this, and I can talk about it, as I mentioned, because nobody can fire me, and I don't need to get elected. And some people say they're going to boycott me when they hear about my policies on American drug policy and so on, and I just think they're not going to take my tours or use my books and that sort of thing, and I just think Europe's going to be more fun without you. Today in our country, we have 80,000 people in jail for marijuana. Last year, we arrested more people than ever before on marijuana charges, 800,000 people. It's a waste of money. It's messing up a lot of families, and it is counterproductive. Nobody's saying drugs are good. Nobody's saying kids should have access to it. Nobody's saying you should lighten up on people drinking when they're intoxicated or anything. You're just saying maybe it's smarter to treat marijuana as a civil liberty for adult recreational mature use. And it's not across the board in Europe, but that seems to be a more pragmatic solution. And I think California is leading the way right now in the United States with things, and things are really getting traction in this area. If you want to learn more about that, this is not a talk about drug policy, but if you Google Rick Steves' marijuana, you can find everything I got to say about that. Okay, there's a chapter on that in the Travel as a Political Act book. But what I've learned about this is from talking to policemen in the Netherlands and talking to people who are dealing with that problem here in the United States, and it is quite an interesting thing. Europeans are so different from us, and they're so the same also, you know. And I just think part of it is, in Europe, they are more humanist, they are more socialist in the sense of, let's pay a lot of taxes with high expectations. In Europe, they have government by, for, and of the people, we have government by, for, and of the people. The difference? I think we here in America choose government by, for, and of the people via the corporations we own. It's not good or bad, it's just we like to create a good business atmosphere so the corporations we own can prosper and we can prosper. In Europe, they have government by, for, and of the people in spite of the corporations they own. You see, you'll find bad-for-business laws in Europe that are good for long-term sustainability, which in actuality are good for businesses too. So we can look at that and we can learn how Europe is going. I would say when you want to see Europe in the extreme, you go to Scandinavia, the most highly taxed part of Europe. And up in Scandinavia, you find not a church on the main square, but you find a city hall on the main square. This is Stockholm, that is Oslo. And you would have a nave like this with a bunch of people getting together, and a lectern, and mosaics behind the lectern celebrating not Bible stories, but heroic individuals who have contributed mightily to their community. You see, it's a celebration of humanism, and they work together to make their communities have a higher threshold of decency. I asked my friend in Switzerland, Ollie, how can you people so docilely pay such high taxes? And without missing a beat, he says, well, what's it worth to live in a society where there's no hunger, no homelessness, and where everybody's got access to quality health care and education? It's just an ethic for them. It's not a crusade. It's not anything other than this is how we want our society. They are every bit as capitalistic as us, but they just have a higher bar for the losers in capitalism, you see. And they just would rather live in a society that doesn't have people on the streets. I think Americans are beautiful, caring people, but one thing we are not very good at is recognizing the gap between rich and poor, between us and the poor world, and between wealthy people and well-off people and poor people in our own country. And when you travel, that gap becomes very apparent. And what I have found in my travels is even if you're motivated only by greed, if you know what's good for you, you don't want to be filthy rich in a desperately poor world. It's just not a pretty picture. That's the beautiful thing about traveling, is you see our country in high contrast, our problems, where they're taking us. And here's a community in Central America where there's an armed guard on every street. And you have designer fortifications. When I doze off in San Salvador or Managua and I on the bus and I feel street bumps, speed bumps, I know if I open my eyes and look to the right, I'll see the home of a rich person. You don't buy a big house in El Salvador without putting street bumps in front of it, so angry people have to slow down before they throw explosives into your yard, you see. Then they can take the license plate and get those angry poor people. I was just driving from Dallas out to Plano in Texas, past 10 miles of fortified front yards. Wealthy people who want their kids to get out and get some fresh air, they've got chicken wire over the front so they can be safe and get outside, too, from all those poor kids in the street. You know, maybe these poor kids are lazy or they got parents that are all screwed up or something, but it's just not a scenario you want to raise your families in. So when we travel, we can gain an empathy for that, and we can come home determined to do something constructive about it. You see beautiful kids in your travels that are every bit as precious as our kids. And when I look at these girls on a garbage dump in El Salvador, I see every bit as much deserving beauty there as my own daughter. And I know my daughter's got $5,000 for straight teeth and money left over for whitener. And I looked around her class, and every girl apparently has $5,000 for straight teeth and money left over for whitener. You know, that's not a bad thing. I don't apologize for that. We have a winning society. I work hard. My daughter gets straight teeth. But that doesn't negate the fact that in this village, the moms are not home because they're out walking for water. And for the cost of two sets of braces, you could drill a well in that thirsty community so parents could stay home and take care of their kids. That's not a guilt trip. That's an opportunity. And I was just lobbying for Bread for the World a little bit in Washington, D.C., going to different congresspeople, and I kept hearing this notion of soft power. Even conservatives from military districts are realizing soft power could be more effective and cost-effective for us than waging hard power. Imagine if you spent $10,000 and built a well for that community. Every time those families gathered water like this instead of hiking away from their families, they'd think America. That's a powerful way to win hearts and minds in your travels. Well, we're confronted with some pretty serious problems as we deal with angry Islam and we deal with the growing gap between rich and poor and climate change and all this kind of thing. And I find that in our travels, we can learn, we can come home, and we can employ that new perspective and be not only happier Americans, but better citizens of this planet. And that's a very rewarding kind of travel. That's my favorite souvenir, and that's why I'm talking today about travel as a political act. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks.
Our thanks to Rick Steves, PBS travel host and author of the new book, Travel is a Political Act. As a reminder for our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Rick Steves, acclaimed PBS travel host and writer who's discussing how to get the most out of international travel. So now we're at the session for question and answers, and there are some fantastic questions that have been asked by the audience. As a good segue to what you were mentioning there at the last minute is a question from the audience of how do we encourage people to become citizen ambassadors? And more importantly, when they return home, how do they keep that ethic alive and spread that vision and spread that message?
Well, how do we encourage people to travel in a way that broadens our perspective? We have to remember that it's a little bit subversive from an industrial point of view. The biggest industry on this planet, if you measured in employment, would be tourism. And they would rather have you just laying on the beach and, you know, doing all that fun stuff. I got no problem with that. But remember, you have the option to complement that by not leaving your hotel and going to the left down to the riverside where all the touristy restaurants are and the floodlit bridge, but turning right, as I did in Mostar in Bosnia just recently, and going to the former front line of the Civil War they had, the boulevard, the main street in Mostar, which 20 years ago, 15 years ago, had corpses laying there who couldn't be retrieved because it was in the line of fire of the snipers. And to realize now the community's coming together. The church spires and the minarets are still all around. The bullet-parked walls are there. And you've got the very first, I'm just thinking of what I did a couple months ago in Mostar, the very first restaurants opening up on what was the front line. I could have gone down to the tourist places. That would have been fun. I took a right instead of a left. I saved a lot of money. I made a lot of friends. I was received as a guest rather than part of the economy. I didn't incur any risk, and I learned. I could have gone to Mazatlan. I went to San Salvador. You see, there's just two ways that we can travel. So the choice is yours. And it's fun to go on the cruise. It's fun to go to Mazatlan. But break away from that and realize that you need to take the initiative. Nobody who advertises and who greases the skids on where your travel dreams are going to take you is interested in you spending less money and learning more. So that's just up to you.
Many of the questions that the audience had actually revolved around travel to Iran, Morocco, Egypt, and other places within the Islamic world. What are some suggestions that you would have for people interested in traveling there of how better to approach it, particularly for somebody who is not a frequent traveler?
If you're thinking about going to Islam, I think you got to remember there's secular Islam and there's theocratic Islam. The Islam that fills the headlines for us, I think, is theocracy, like Iran, where you've got a country that has traded away the separation of mosque and state in order to have this, the promise that their values will survive encroachment from the West. I like going to, it's more happy for me to go to Morocco or Turkey, where you have a secular society. When you're in Iran, I forget if I mentioned this in my talk, but in Turkey, the military is obligated to overthrow its own government if it ever becomes a theocracy. And it's done that a couple of times. The Turks are very adamant about the separation of mosque and state. And to go to Istanbul is just an exciting opportunity. To go to Morocco and to see a society that is succeeding without even thinking about the United States. They don't necessarily think good about us or bad about us. They're just doing their own thing. And I really enjoy traveling in places that are not focused on the United States, but are developing in their own way, on their own terms, and so on.
Many of the questions also were with regards to your program itself, particularly with regards to, are you looking to expand the scope from beyond Europe to focus on Asia or Latin America?
It's so fun to be a travel teacher, and I'm kind of humble about what it takes to be worth trusting. And I really have a beat. I'm focused on Europe. I'm staying focused on Europe. I've got 70 or 80 people that work with me in Seattle at Europe Through the Back Door, and we do Europe. To me, Europe is the wading pool for world exploration. It's where you go first, and then you get confident, and you realize travel's fun, and then you can go to South Asia or Latin America or whatever. It's just my personal thing. My cultural roots are in Europe. That's where I'm inclined to go. That's what I'm enthusiastic about. It's a big market also, so you know, I have to factor in, am I going to make any money by writing a book to this place? If I write a book to Lithuania, nobody's going to buy it. If I write a book to Paris, it's going to make a lot of money. So I have to be realistic about that. And I want to work hard and have people use what I'm doing. I just spent a lot of time on the Camino de Santiago, going across northern Spain to Santiago. There's 100,000 people make that pilgrimage trek every year, but not many Americans. And I was thinking, what am I doing here? None of my market is doing this. I'm spending a lot of time, a lot of energy, covering an area that Americans are not inclined to go to. I have to factor that in. I want to encourage people to go there. It's great. On the other hand, everybody's in Madrid and needs help. So I can go there and work on my chapter to Madrid. So it's a fun challenge I have. But I'm staying focused on Europe from my guidebook writing point of view, our tour program, and my TV programs. The one difference is my radio program, which I get to be the conduit of information because I love traveling around the whole world. And on my weekly radio show, I get to interview people who are experts in any corner of the world, and that's really fun. If I wasn't doing this work, I would go to India. India is my favorite country, or the whole Indian subcontinent, Sri Lanka, Nepal, and so on.
When thinking about travel as a political act, certainly for the United States, one area does come straight to mind, and that would be Cuba.
Right. Yeah, Cuba's... Cuba, a lot of Americans think, oh, can you go to Cuba? Cuba's the number one Caribbean resort for Canadians and Germans. You know, of course you can go to Cuba. And people who, Americans who have the, what's the Spanish word, cojones, to go to Cuba.
Cojones.
Cojones, thank you. I knew I could count on Mark for that linguistic. Kahuna. Americans that do go to Cuba, I've never heard anything but wonderful reports on how dear the people are and how creative they are with their struggles and what it's like to live under Castro and all this kind of thing. The irony is, I think the only reason Castro's in power is because of our embargo, you know. It's just that's why Ahmadinejad's in power, because we're so easy to demonize. If we weren't so easy to demonize, these people would have freedom. But they trade away their freedom out of fear. That's why Iran is a theocracy. It's because they're afraid of another Western puppet in their government. People love Cuba. My whole political fire was lit in Central America, and I would love to go to Cuba. It's just I got my hands full keeping my guidebooks up to date in Europe, I guess. My Iran thing was sort of a one-off. People think, oh, are you going to start going over there now? No, that was just, I just considered it citizen diplomacy. I have an opportunity because of my work in public television to go there. There was a lot of saber-rattling, and I really thought it's pathetic what Americans know about Iran. What we know about Iran in general, we learn from Ted Koppel. And that's no basis to really understand a country. Their history goes back quite a bit before the late 1970s, and we need to know about that to deal with them smartly.
Your books and your programs are very focused upon an American audience. If you were if your audience was European or right. of a different background, how would you change it, particularly if you're reporting about the United States?
Well, my books are focused on Americans, and that's what I do. I don't compromise my books at all. My publisher might like me to do that, so we'd have a better market outside of the United States. But I'm helping my community enjoy Europe. That's sort of very narrow, but that's what I want to do. So if people from Mexico or Canada want to use my books, I don't list their embassies. You know, I don't do any compromise. That's not a compromise, but I don't even try to be inclusive that way. I want Americans, who I think are the most ethnocentric people around, to have the chance to go over there and meet a guy in a park in Stockholm who's hanging out with his little tiny baby and little daughter on a Wednesday afternoon. And you ask him, aren't you supposed to be at work? And he says, no, here in Sweden we get 16 months of parental leave to split between the mom and the dad any way we like, and it's use it or lose it. Oh, that's fascinating. Tell me more. You know, I want to talk to Europeans. I want to meet the couple that's passing a joint around under the shadow of the cathedral in Bern, Switzerland, and playing backgammon. You're just smoking marijuana right here in public. What's going on? What do you mean? What's the problem? You know, that's just different. It's fascinating. I want to go to a bullfight in Madrid, and you guys are slaughtering this beast, and it's just theater. Well, yeah, we think of it not. It doesn't. The report of this bullfight is not going to be in the sports section. It's going to be in the arts section of the newspaper. Now, I don't endorse it, but I don't want to shelter myself from that, and I want to find out what is this with this culture. I want to go to Turkey and be disgusted with my Turkish friends for having these ugly buildings with unfinished rebar, rusty rebar sticking up into the sky. Have some aesthetics here. Cover that up. And then they tell me, well, no, here in Turkey we don't put money in the bank because it just withers away. It's an ethic of ours to leave our children with a home, and whenever we get $100, we build another wall or a window or a door or a floor, and we leave the rebar out so that we can build the next stage when we get a little more money for our children. Here in Turkey we say rebar holds the family together. Oh, then I feel like a fool, you know? Oh, I like that rebar. All of a sudden, it's beautiful. So when I travel, I get to expose myself to that, and that's a lot of fun.
Speaking of children, in the age of Nintendo and Sony PlayStations, how do we encourage our kids to travel?
How do we encourage our kids to travel? Well, my parents dragged me to Europe, and I didn't want to go. I remember I'm a lucky kid. My dad used to import pianos from Germany, and we had to see the piano factories, or the relatives up in Norway. And I remember being over there, a 14-year-old with a very bad attitude. And all of a sudden, I got over there against my will, and I realized, wow, different candy, different pop, statuesque women with hairy armpits. This is really, it's quite interesting. You know, sometimes you got to introduce people to that. My son really never liked to travel very much, and now he's on his own, and he's traveling every summer, and the world is his playground, and he's writing a website that is helping students on their summer break, on their semester abroad program, organize their time for their 3-day weekends to get the most out of that part of their foreign study program. Kids who are introduced to travel, they're more comfortable with people who are different than them. And I see it in my own kids. My son was kind of racist with his attitude about people who are different than him, and I could understand it. We live in a very comfortable white suburb of Seattle, you know, and all of a sudden he travels around the world and he thinks differently about people. I mean, it shouldn't take having to travel to get that way, but that's one way that you can be more open-minded, and I thought that was very valuable, and I'm thankful for having had the wherewithal to help our kids travel, and now they've got a real taste for it.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached a point in our conversation where we only have time for one last question. And since we have spoken about sex, drugs, rock and roll, rap, I thought it would be fitting to end on one of the other interest points, which is, given your international flavors, what kind of food do you cook at home?
You know, that's a good question. My wife's a great cook. I'm not a good cook at all. I'm a great picnicker. I eat healthy, but I just like to sort of have healthy food. But the problem with traveling is, we love Italian food, but I don't like to go to an Italian restaurant in the United States because I'm reminded this is not Europe. There's something about the ambience in an Italian restaurant in Italy, or a French restaurant in France, or an Irish pub in Ireland, which you just can't duplicate. So it's sort of a problem with my work is I spend 120 nights a year out looking at restaurants and sampling stuff, and when I get home, I'm sort of not interested in anything too dazzling. I'm just...
So hamburgers, then.
Hamburgers is good. Yeah, that's right.
Well, our thanks to Rick Steves, PBS travel host and author of the new book, Travel is a Political Act. We also thank our audience here and on the radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Mark Casso, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.